There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Today on Truth and Movies, we're passing judgment on the sci-fi action sequel Terminator Dark Fate.
My name is Sarah Connor, and I hunt Terminators.
Matthew McConaughey is all high, all high, all high in the stoner comedy The Beach Bum.
I like that fun, man.
And in Film Club, it's long, it's dark, it's directed by James Cameron. Join us as we stare into the abyss.
You mean you got liquid in your lungs?
Well, coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Yes, hello there, movie truthers. Welcome back to another episode of Truth and Movies. It's Michael Leader here, sitting in the host chair across this week from Matt Thrift.
Hi.
And Steph Watts.
Hello.
Welcome back both. How are we doing? Matt, you okay?
Okay, yeah, getting over my own dark fate of a few days of the lurgy, but otherwise okay.
And Steph?
Yeah, I'm great. Sailing along a boat in Florida. I'm living
my life. Matthew McConaughey dream.
Yeah.
We'll talk about both Dark Fate and The Beach Bum very shortly. We have a bit of follow-up from last week's episode here from Jeff. Hi all, long-time listener to the pod. This email is more an observation after I listened to your recent podcast where you reviewed Zombieland 2. Eleanor Lazich mentioned that in anticipation of reviewing the movie, she watched the first Zombieland film a few days beforehand. Then, after watching number two, she said it was basically retreading the same material over again, and hence she didn't really like it, amongst other things. Given Eleanor only watched the original for the first time a few days beforehand, could that have influenced her review for a film that was always likely to retread old ground, especially since it has been 10 years since the original? Wondering if you guys have had any similar issues when researching reviews where in order to watch a follow-up or preceding film in order to write the review, where the lack of a break between the two viewings may have coloured your impression due to overload or repetition of a similar theme. And Jeff says here that he thought the most recent Mission Impossible film, Fallout, was excellent, but if he'd just seen Rogue Nation, the previous film in the franchise, day two beforehand, he might have been a little bit, oh, here we go again. That's a very interesting email there, Jeff. And quite, yeah, it gets to the heart of something, a question here that we ask ourselves. Steph, you were last on for Hobbs and Shaw, the Fast and Furious spin-off. Obviously, you are our Fast and Furious expert in-house. You seem to be watching Fast and Furious films all the time, but did you watch any specifically before Hobbs and Shaw?
Always watching. Well, before Hobbs and Shaw, I actually watched all of the Fast and Furious movies to get in the zone, I guess, and just kind of revisit some of the older ones and just see how they hold up. And, well, I think it did kind of colour my expectations for Hobbs and Shaw just because I think there are some genuinely good films in that franchise, and I think it was interesting to go back and watch them and revisit them. But I don't know. I think if a film is kind of 10 years old and you're doing a sequel to it, you might expect people to go and rewatch the first one and not just kind of have vague memories of it and just go into a sequel.
And we should say that it often really depends on the quality of this sequel, and many franchises encourage you go back and rewatch earlier editions in the franchise. For example, this week the tickets went on sale for The Rise of Skywalker, the last installment in the most recent Star Wars.
Yeah, I overslept. I don't know how I'm going to see it now.
Exactly.
I missed that.
But the tickets are on sale, and so many cinemas up and down the country and around the world are showing the two previous episodes beforehand. For Avengers Endgame, there were people doing their all-nighters watching every Marvel movie. And
the inverse is also true of the first film we're going to talk about this week, because it has the two movies that came before this one wipes out and goes back to as a sequel to the second Terminator. So they actively don't want you to watch the watch the other ones to colour.
Do you think that colours your estimation of a film, Matt? Especially, Jeff also mentions in his email, if we rewatched Goodfellas the day before going to see The Irishman, the new Martin Scorsese film, would that be almost a good idea or a bad idea.
I mean, I would say in the case of this one, I mean, revisiting Salvation and Genesis only did this film the world of favours, given how bad they were and how low my expectations were going into this.
Well, that's a spoiler alert for our for our review of Terminator Dark Fate, which is coming up right now. Welcome to the day after Judgment Day. Returning to their iconic roles from James Cameron's first two Terminator films, Linda Hamilton and Arnold Schwarzenegger lead a new cast in this soft reboot of the action-packed sci-fi series, which picks up over 20 years after Sarah Connor, with the help of a good T-800 Terminator, successfully prevent the apocalyptic rise of Skynet. But the future holds more potentially perilous threats.
My name is Sarah Connor, and I hunt Terminators. Enough of a resume for you.
Sarah Connor, the day has come. I'm going to help you change the future.
So you're Carl?
That's what everyone calls me.
I'm never gonna call you Carl.
It's the most lethal Terminator ever created.
Expect a big pain, brother. Whole body's a weapon.
Sorry.
That thing will keep coming. We don't win this one. It's all over.
It's a lot of bangs.
Yeah, so many bangs. A clip from the trailer for Terminator Dark Fate there. Matt, tee this one up for us.
Okay, so back in 2005, Chris Rock was hosting the Oscars. And in his introductory monologue that he did at the beginning, he said that, you know, people tell me that this is the night of 1,000 stars, but it really isn't. There aren't 1,000 stars sitting here tonight. There are like 4 stars, and the rest of you are just popular people. And he was kind of bemoaning the fact that, you know, there weren't enough stars for the amount of movies that were being made every single week. And he earned the ire, quite famously, of Sean Penn by saying, you know, if you want Tom Cruise for your movie, but he's not available, and all you can get is Jude Law, well, then you just wait. You know, it's not the same thing. Ja Rule isn't the same as Tupac. Well, Tim Miller, director of Terminator Dark Fate, and the reasonably financially successful Deadpool, is the kind of definition, I think, of a popular person. And he's certainly not James Cameron, and certainly, on the evidence of this, not much of a star. This isn't really a good film. I mean, you know, when held up against, you know, the kind of clockwork Marvel that is, you know, the first Terminator film, that movie is kind of leaner than one of Jennifer Aniston's celery shakes. And then you've got Terminator 2, which is, you know, what that rare example of a real character-driven blockbuster. And, you know, James Cameron's staging on that film is just, it's just out of this world. And but then also, it's not a bad film, I guess, when you hold it up against, you know, the video game cutscene that was Terminator Salvation, or the just absolutely incoherent gibberish that was Terminator Genesis. So, I mean, this film, it's you know, this is a thoroughly modern, modern is the wrong word. It's a real, really contemporary blockbuster in that it's power driven by CGI spectacle, nostalgia, fan service. I mean, it plays lip service to kind of issues like immigration, and in the kind of instance of Mackenzie Davis's cyborg, you know, part human, part robot, non-binary kind of character. I mean, there's, again, but it's all lip service. You know, it doesn't really say anything especially interesting about any of these things. I mean, you know, of course it's great to see Linda Hamilton back, but Terminator 2, that was such an iconic character. You know, this maternal, protective, primal figure is now reduced to, you know, like an angry alcoholic that really likes crisps. You know, that's kind of the beats that we're playing with. I guess there's some new stuff here, but none of the sort of boundary pushing things. I remember my dad taking me to see Terminator 2. I was 10, sneaking me into Odeon Streatham, and, you know, my jaw was on the floor for, you know, as I imagine most people's were that summer. And this is just, you know, there are new things. You know, Gabriel Luna's kind of exo-endo-splitting twin Terminator shtick that he's got is, you know, on the face of it, an interesting idea. But you know, we're so kind of numbed by this CGI spectacle. Now, it's interesting, like, James Cameron went on the record a couple of days ago. He was asked about Ang Lee's Gemini Man and the use of the high frame rate and whether he'd be using it for the Avatar films. He hadn't seen Ang Lee's film, and as much as he wanted to, he saw it more as a tool that you could use in certain sequences to help the 3D effects and so on, but not as something that he would, as a medium that he would paint the entire film with. And I think the same applies when you look back at Terminator 2, and it's, you know, again, boundary pushing, and we're going to talk about The Abyss later, which does the same. It's used in such kind of small moments in parallel to the practical effects, which really make up the most of it, that when they are used, and they're used differently and it's new, that kind of sense of awe and wonder. Whereas with this, for all of its kind of kineticism and motion, and, you know, it does go back to, I guess, the founding principles of the Terminator series, which is that it's a chase film and it's got some kind of movement to it. Again, it's got none of James Cameron's sense of character or staging or spectacle. It's like a totally fine couple of hours that passes the time, but it's yeah.
I think I enjoyed this more than you did. I would not say it's a great film. What this film is it's doing what The Force Awakens did to Star Wars for the Terminator franchise. James Cameron is back on board. He's co-producing and one of the six credited screenwriters
on
this. Yeah,
he did
on
his lunch break, didn't he?
He punched something up.
Yeah.
Of course, bringing back a lot of fan service, trying to drill down into what people... Maybe it's not what quite worked in the first two films, but maybe what people in their nostalgic memory of those two films want from a Terminator movie.
Sure.
I have an interesting relationship with the Terminator movie. Whenever someone talks about how the remake of Ghostbusters ruined their childhood, I always tell them about the Terminator series, where I didn't watch any of the sequels from 3 onwards.
Right.
1 and 2, I had them on video when I was a kid and just watched them incessantly and watched them since. And I just didn't bother with any of the other sequels because I knew I wouldn't get anything from them. But then they've tempted me back with this. It's a film full of certain highlights for me,
yeah.
One being Linda Hamilton. So that performance she gives in Judgment Day is out of this world. And she was then pretty badly served by both James Cameron and the Hollywood establishment in the years after that. And the fact that she's given an introduction in this film like she is some returning titan, like she is Harrison Ford in The Force Awakens.
And she's got that kind of sardonic delivery all the way through.
And she can pull it off. Compare this with Arnold Schwarzenegger or Sylvester Stallone's late career sort of films like Escape Plan or The Expendables. She can swagger and deliver those one-liners, but then also find that core of the character again, I think.
I mean, I enjoyed it enough, but I think it's almost depressing that, and I think it says something about the blockbuster landscape that we're in, that something that, as far as I'm concerned, really is probably about a 2-star movie, but in my mind, watching it, I'm kind of elevated because this is so much better than so much else of the rubbish that we're served up on a weekly basis.
That's a definite caveat to have, Steph.
Yeah, I think the expectation when I saw the trailer, I was just like, I'm so not up for this. Like, just kind of rehashing old franchises, especially at the time where we are getting a lot of reboots and sequels of these kind of big old franchises, and it just kind of felt like, yeah, really not into it. But I think I was quite pleasantly surprised. And I think kind of the new characters, like Mackenzie Davis and Gabriel Luna's characters, I think they worked really well with the old ones. And I think it kind of slotted in quite well. It's kind of part nostalgia, part new stuff. And I think, although, yeah, there is a lot of CGI, I think some of it was quite well done and worked quite well. Like, I think the... seeing the first Terminator whenever I saw it is terrifying. And I think all that stuff of his kind of skin coming off because he doesn't regenerate and stuff like that is what makes it quite creepy. And but then with this one, where he has this kind of, he can get out of his own skeleton and he's all this kind of weird goo that just kind of comes all back together, and the way the robot kind of stands up again, it's like one of those Boston Dynamic,
the big dog
robots that absolutely terrify me anyway. So I think the fear of like robots taking over is like put in quite well with this.
They do try and find, and it's actually quite interesting, the solution. A way to do a new Terminator is to have, what if the Robert Patrick Terminator was on top of the body of the T-800? So you have the skeleton of a Terminator with the drippy liquid Terminator on top.
I guess we're going to talk about James Cameron more later when we get onto The Abyss, but just thinking about like the love story at the heart of the first film, or you know, the dynamic between Sarah and John in the second, you know, these are not extraneous to the action and to everything. You know, they're so beautifully integrated, especially the first one, I think, is a... Yeah, it works like clockwork. And this kind of had all of sort of the parts or facsimiles of the parts, but none of it really holds together in any kind of semblance of a whole beyond, I guess, just the chase and let's just keep moving, which was, you know, effective enough.
And to call back to Jeff's email at the head of the episode, this might be one of those films which could go either way. If you've recently watched the first two James Cameron films, it might just pale in comparison, as you just said, Matt. Or you might find it quite intriguing to see how this film is remixing and recalibrating elements from those two films. You have lines that are sort of echoed through the scripts, kind of cack-handedly at times. You have relationships that are harked to. You have whole sequences that are almost flipped on their head. The famous breaking in to break out of the mental institution in Judgment Day is here restaged at a border police force detention centre.
Yeah.
The way that Tim Miller has clearly drilled down into the visual language of this franchise to try and see what can be reprised here, it may just be showing a lack of new ideas, but it can be quite interesting.
I think that raises a kind of larger... And I was thinking this watching Genesis the other week as well. You know, that was directed by Alan Taylor, you know, who did... His first movie was Thor, and then he did that after. And then Tim Miller, who's only got Deadpool and this. And I do wonder, you know, I would love to read a really honest interview with a director of that kind working at that level, where you've got a producer as powerful as James Cameron, you've got a studio that's desperate to resuscitate its franchise, and you've got stars, you know, as powerful as the likes of Arnie and probably even Linda Hamilton in this case. You know, how much they actually did direct this. Are these set pieces, are these action scenes, are they the ones that are working these things out? I mean, compared to, for example, pull a name out of the air, someone like, who's a great action director these days, George Miller or, you know, Colette Serra, taking this material on that actually has an aesthetic, has a vision, has an identity beyond, you know, James Cameron taking on the Alien franchise. You know, his second film is a completely different beast while still living in the perfect universe that we expected from Alien. And yet it does something wholly different with that. And I just wonder, how much of it is actually directed by these people and what a real filmmaker.
I think the line you can draw from Deadpool to this is there is a certain acrobatic kineticism to some of the fight choreography, as much as that is sort of CGI'd to become something like a computer-generated zombie in sort of real people. There is something there, the use of slow-mo, the use of impossible camera shots and so on. There are some sequences in this that I thought were quite good for what makes a 2019 action film. The first scene where you see Gabriel Luna's Terminator attacking the main characters, which is in a car factory where they've just been told they're being replaced by machines. It's a very, you know, capital T Trump era script, this, isn't it? Where, I mean, it stops quite short of them literally going through a border wall, but they're trying to cross the border. I think there's something there with Tim Miller, but he's so new and so young as a filmmaker, we don't get a sense of his overarching vision. It would be interesting, but that's not what these franchises are for now, are they? Steph, Arnie, we know from the trailer that he's in this. Did that resound for you as a person who watched and liked the early films? Is he back?
I think when he actually appears, I was into it. I think they did that return quite well. I think they give him a good kind of explanation as to his situation and where he is in the film. Yeah, I think it works quite well, and I was quite pleased with how they did it.
I don't want to say too much about the way that Arnie's used. I think the trailer gives us almost too much away, and his interviews on the promotional tour have as well. It's quite surprising, also brings with it maybe a little shift of tone, we could say.
It's very droll, isn't it?
Yeah. And what's surprising is that a star the size of Arnold Schwarzenegger seems happy to have ceded the ground to a large extent to Linda Hamilton for this to be her film, it feels like.
It's interesting that, I mean, the kind of, and again, I mean, I don't think it goes especially deep on this, but there is definitely a kind of interesting lip service paid to sexual politics in this, in this as well. Linda Hamilton, at one point, I think she says, you know, Mum and Dad are having an argument, and there's a moment when Arnie asks Mackenzie Davis, you know, can I ask what you are? And she just shuts him down and says, no, you may not. And there's, you know, again, these kind of, it's almost frustrating that, well, maybe it isn't. Maybe if it had gone harder into these things, it would have.
It feels like peppering. You can really see how this was a screenplay written by committee. You can imagine versions of this film with the younger cast members, then you can see that there was the Linda Hamilton pass, then you can see that there was the Arnold Schwarzenegger pass. And that has a cumulative effect where this film does drag in its second half, just because you have action sequences where you have so many actors within that action sequence where everyone has to have an equal part. And that's where, you know, Matt, you mentioned how the first Terminator is so sleek. Mm-hmm. The second film builds, but still has that forward momentum, which takes you through nearly two and a half hours, as if the time hasn't passed at all. This film feels as long as it is, and maybe that's what, for me, drags it down a little bit. We should move on. We've got The Abyss to talk about. There's a whole another 3 hours of James Cameron sci-fi to talk about. But let's put some scores on this. Matt, I'll come to you first. In anticipation, enjoyment, in retrospect.
So anticipation, I mean, probably a pretty low, like a one or a two. I mean, the last couple were really, really bad, and I didn't like Deadpool, and the trailer wasn't especially impressive for this when I saw it a while back. Enjoyment, I mean, three. I had a fun enough time there, and then in retrospect, a two, because it's the more I've thought about it, the... Yeah.
Steph?
I think a one for anticipation was really not feeling it. Yeah, I think like a three for enjoyment, and I think like a three in retrospect. Like, I don't think it's a bad movie, but I think it's fine, and I think it's enjoyable enough that it's okay.
Yeah, I'll say 2, 4, 3. I'm going to be positive. Ooh. On this one.
Nice.
Really enjoyable in the moment, although I will say that the, can you even call it a Terminator theme? It's just some, it's a percussive motif.
So it's done, yeah, to it's, death. It's what's his name, isn't it? It's Junkie XL has done Brad Fiedel's Terminator theme, and
which is basically a drum line and then a short synth motif that is in this one, given the Mexican rearrangement that you never knew that you needed or wanted.
I remember quite liking the sound actually in this was
But I think that if you want to go and see a Terminator film, what a 2019 Terminator film may be, this is good. It's not Mad Max Fury Road, it's not got an overarching vision behind it, but it delivers some of those nostalgic thrills, and there are things I will remember about this film going forward, even if I don't remember much of the film otherwise. But that's Terminator Dark Fate in cinemas this weekend. Up next, we're off to the Florida Keys with Matthew McConaughey in The Beach Bum. The latest from writer-director Harmony Korine, The Beach Bum follows the misadventures of Moondog, played by Matthew McConaughey, the so-called most prolific poet of the Florida Keys. Moondog is a rebellious rogue and insatiable stoner who always lives life by his own rules.
Thank you for meeting with me today.
Man, my pleasure. I don't remember the last time I did one of these.
Got an interesting life. How'd you pull it off? How'd you do it?
I only pull it off how I do it. I mean, look, I could tell you that I've been trying to uncover the abyss beneath my illusory connection with the world. I could tell you that it's all written in the stars. I could tell you that I'm a reverse paranoid. I'm quite certain that the world is conspiring to make me happy, all three of which are true, but it's really a little simpler than that. I like to have fun, man.
Matthew McConaughey there in the role he was born to play, some would say. Steph, what is The Peach Bum?
So it's Matthew McConaughey in Florida.
Yep.
With Harmony Korine.
Does he wear a shirt at all in this movie?
Oh, I don't know. He wears plenty of, like, dresses. I don't know if he wears a shirt.
He's pretty topless. I'd say semi-topless at all times.
He has that amazing wedding outfit where it's, like, flames, like a...
Guy Fieri type.
Yeah, very, very good. But, yeah, basically he's kind of an old, washed-up sea dog poet. And he's trying to write this book so that he can actually get some money, because he has no money, and he's just kind of wandering around with his friend Snoop Dogg.
Yeah.
And yeah, just a very rambling kind of nice adventure.
So this is from Harmony Korine, who's made some really quite gross movies in his time, grotesque movies from Gummo onwards. Yeah. Most recently, Spring Breakers, that Dayglow Spring Break movie. And then this seems to be a complete bolt out of the blue for him stylistically, Matt, would you say? Or tonally, maybe?
I think it latches on to Spring Breakers. I mean, I think Spring Breakers was a big tonally bolt out of the blue compared to what he'd done before. I mean, God, I just love this film so much. For the first, I guess, 20 minutes or so, you know, I just don't really want to say too much about an event that kind of happens, about a third of the way in. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was one thing, and I thought it was going to remain that. There's this just kind of Matthew McConaughey kind of smoking blunts with Snoop Dogg and wandering around Florida. Mm-hmm. But it really became this investigation into mortality and the price of holding on to what we have and what we had. And I found it's kind of beautifully rambling and shambolic and just one of the great kind of hangout movies. You know, Spring Breakers is quite sort of defiantly political in kind of what it has to say about millennials and Obama era and so on. You know, what that film kind of aspired to, Matthew McConaughey's character in this kind of has and doesn't really want. I mean, his wife is like a multi-millionaire, but none of the money belongs to him, and he just kind of doesn't really care about it. I think he's got a line about 10 minutes in. It's just like, he comes back to his wife, is it, baby, I forgot how rich we were. this, you know, it's really episodic. You know, some of it's kind of borderline offensive, I guess. But, you know, it's got Martin Lawrence as a shanty captain with a cocaine-addicted parrot who, you know, has an altercation with a shark. And, I mean, it's just, you know, while it does kind of skirt with the ridiculous, these people all seem to inhabit these characters and inhabit that landscape. And it's just so kind of tender and gentle and empathetic and really touching.
I was expecting all the way through for the other shoe to drop in some way. Like there would be some turn or some, I don't know. But it just keeps on its merry way. It's very good company, this film. Yeah. And to the point where I almost had a galaxy brain moment where this film felt like a pastiche spoof comment on the stoner comedy of No Consequence. That this was, if the Big Lebowski had married Maud at the end of the film and become rich and could just be a dropout for the rest of his life. Or almost a commentary on Rodney Dangerfield comedies where you have this guy just barreling through other people's lives where impervious to reality.
Yeah, and in the same way that Spring Breakers being political, and that was about, you know, kind of aspiration, and we need to get this and we need to get, you know, get that and so on. This is about somebody, you know, the baby boomer generation that's, well, I've got everything now, so now what the hell do I do with it? And he just kind of tunes in and drops out, and it's lovely.
I do think as well the more films that Harmony Korine has made, I think I've seen like maybe four or five of his films. And I think the more he makes and the kind of maybe mellower he gets, the better it gets. Like I think you have these Gummo type characters maybe, but they feel more fleshed out and they feel more empathetic, and you don't feel like you're just watching like a freak show. You actually feel like you are getting to know people, and like you might kind of pass through this life with Moondog and you meet all these crazy characters. But yeah, it feels a lot more kind of empathetic and loving and warm, and I think it's not just kind of trying to do stuff for the sake of it.
It seems like the Korean project as a whole, you know, from Gummo and, you know, even the quite bad, like Mr. Lonely, Trash Humpers, all of these, and these new ones, it's about that kind of, you know, finding your people, finding your own crowd.
And it's something from that episodic nature, which can almost feel like a variety show at times, you know, Mr. Lonely with its cameos and Spring Breakers with its breakout moments. This has that in spades. You can also have a whole roll call of the cameos in this. Jonah Hill, Martin Lawrence. This film has Jimmy Buffett and Snoop Dogg collaborating on a theme tune for the main character before our very eyes. The collaboration you can never predict.
But it's those little kind of quieter moments. There's a scene with, after his daughter gets married, where he just goes off with his wife, Isla Fisher, and they just kind of dance around the jetties and smoke a joint and kind of sing to each other, and it's just this kind of like 3 or 4 minute little montage that's just, I mean, at that point I was like, oh, this is just bliss.
It's really bizarre, and we should note this. Snoop Dogg is in 3 films in the next 2 weeks that's either hitting cinemas or hitting streaming platforms. He's in Beach Bum and Dolomite Is My Name on Netflix this week, and he's in The Addams Family next, where he's having a moment. It is a bit like Snoop Doggy Dogtober.
Who is he in The Addams Family?
He's playing Cousin It, apparently. It's strange that this is where he's landed in his career, that he can turn up and be himself. He reportedly didn't want to play himself in this film, so he plays basically...
His character is called Lingerie.
Who is just Snoop Dogg.
Yeah, basically.
What's a bizarre film? Can we talk about Jonah Hill?
Oh, the accent. Yeah,
of course, he made mid-90s early this year. Very much was inspired by early Harmony Korine in that. So I wonder whether this is just the scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. He wants to appear in a Harmony Korine movie with a very bizarre accent as Moondog's long-suffering agent.
Yeah, he's got that kind of Kevin Spacey in Midnight in the Garden of Good and Evil thing going on.
Yeah. Gosh, are we going to recommend this? Steph, what scores would you give The Beach Bum?
Yes. I was maybe like a 4 in anticipation. Like, I really liked Spring Breakers. I thought it was such a good kind of big screen movie experience. I think just straight 4s across the board for this. Yeah, I just really enjoyed it. I think it's really reflective, and I mean, there's like some unnice things in it, but I think it's a really kind of mellow and good time movie.
Good time movie.
And also Zac Efron with his panini beard.
Of course, yeah.
Just atrocious. But
there's something about Harmony Korine that I do find pretty great about him, is that he has that almost documentarian's point of view. Like, so Gummo, literally so, where he's just pulling kids off the street and getting them drunk and filming them. But now he'll, you know, the inspiration for this film is that these are based on people he met when shooting Spring Breakers down in Florida. Or saying that he wanted Zac Efron to have a beard that looks like a panini sandwich he was eating. There are all these elements that just add up to, as you called it, the Harmony Korine project, Matt. But what would you give? What scores would you give this?
So probably 4 in anticipation. I mean, I'll follow Harmony Korine wherever he goes, for better or for worse. And there's some that I've liked a lot more than others. And then, yeah, I mean, 5 and 5. I mean, this, Spring Breakers. I mean, Harmony Korine's is the real Florida project.
Love it. Love the wordplay. And yes, I enjoyed this. I really did. I was confused for most of the runtime, and maybe it's just that I should have given myself over earlier. But listeners, if you do watch it, let me know if you have a similar galaxy brain moment to me, and whether this is a spoof or whether it is just a good time. I'd probably give it 3, 4, 4. It's a strong recommendation from the table for The Beach Bum, which is also in cinemas this week, although quite hard to find, I hear. Maybe a very limited release, so maybe you'll have to track it down when it's out to rent or stream. Another film that's hard to track down at the moment is our film club choice this week, The Abyss.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A civilian oil rig crew is recruited to conduct a search and rescue effort when a nuclear submarine mysteriously sinks. One diver, played by Ed Harris, soon finds himself confronting a mysterious force that has the power to change the world or destroy it. Following his smash hit sci-fi sequel Aliens, James Cameron went big with this long and expensive original. While it didn't set the box office alight back in 1989, it's remembered for its pioneering and Oscar-winning special effects work, and a later special edition director's cut arguably asserts the film's position in Cameron's canon of work. But before we dive into our discussion, let's hear a clip.
Fluid breathing system. We just got them. You use it when you go really deep.
How deep?
Deep.
How deep?
It's classified. Anyway, you breathe liquid so you can't get compressed. The pressure doesn't get you.
You mean you got liquid in your lungs?
Oxygenated fluorocarbon emulsion.
Bullshit.
Check this out. Can I borrow your rack?
What are you doing?
Hey, no.
You're gonna kill her!
It's okay, I've done this myself.
Oh, man, like, what are you, did you just drown in her?
She's gonna be fine. I read this myself. Gonna be fine.
No, man, she's gonna drown. Look, she's freaking out.
Just going through a normal adjustment period.
Normal? Does this look normal to you? She's gonna drown.
He's taking the fluid into his lungs. There he goes. Still has a bit of anxiety here. Now he's starting to relax. He's breathing fine. See his chest moving? Getting plenty of oxygen.
I don't think it really states it in that clip, but that's a mouse that's being drowned. Just off camera, but for real, apparently James Cameron said. It's a real science there they were testing out, where you can breathe oxygenated water. Incredible. Anyway, that's The Abyss. We have some listener comments here. Toby Miller says it's a rare action blockbuster where there's only one moment of gunfire. James Clark says it's possibly James Cameron's finest hour. Dom Holder says it's brilliant and long overdue, a Blu-ray release. I agree. It's really hard to track down. There's a very bad DVD that's available.
Yeah.
It's not available currently on any streaming services either.
Non-anamorphic or something.
Yeah. And then Richard Galbraith says the 171-minute extended version is absolutely necessary. Matt, what's your history with The Abyss? You said you were taken along to Streatham Odeon to see Terminator 2.
Yeah, I think 2. I was probably a bit young for this to see it. I definitely didn't see this at the cinema, but it was a video shop staple as soon as it was available. So, I mean, I'll go to war for James Cameron any day of the week.
We'll invite you back for Avatar 2, 3, 4, 5.
Well, yeah, I mean, a couple of years ago, Jenks and Adam were doing gave us the opportunity to write an essay of what we thought was the best blockbuster of the 21st century, and the amount of stick they gave me for choosing Avatar. I think The Abyss is fantastic. It's interesting, I watched, getting ready for this, what I hadn't watched for a long time was the theatrical cut. I'd always watched the extended one, and it's kind of interesting that comment about the extended one being kind of absolutely necessary, because I think that's kind of a yes and a no. So the extended one adds this sort of extra half hour or so, which is amazing in the whole character building first couple of acts of the film. You just get more time with all of these amazing... nobody kind of sets a scene and sets a group of characters quite like Cameron does. I mean, I can't think of many films beyond like this or Aliens where, you know the name of the sort of eighth ranked supporting character and it feels like he or she has a real identity. It's, he's really kind of Hawksian in creating these kind of dangerous environments with people doing dangerous work and so on. So you get a lot more time there. You get a lot more of the relationship, which, again, like, talking about the love story in the first Terminator, I mean, basically this is like Marriage Story as well, on a submarine or whatever, So you get a lot more of that. But then the payoff is at the end of the film, which is, like Lucas and all these people before him, he felt that he wasn't especially happy with the possibility of the effects. You get this whole Cold War subplot, that's thrown in about destroying the end of the world and World War III on the horizon, and the theatrical edition ends with I think we're far enough out for spoilers.
30 years.
So ends with just Ed Harris going to see these friendly aliens, whereas the extended version becomes this whole... They show him like a montage reel of sort of all the atrocities of, of humankind. And they say, we're going to let you go, but, don't do this again. And it's all quite silly, really.
A little bit. This film isn't very well... It's had its moments where it's been reappraised, of course. I know that Siskel and Ebert upturned their down votes to thumbs up when it was re-released in the special edition in the early 90s. But I think even now, James Cameron was the king of the high-concept film where the title is the film, Aliens, The Terminator, Judgment Day, Titanic, The Abyss.
I mean, don't get me wrong, I think it's really, really, really great.
Oh, no, of course. Yeah. But it's not very well known just what it is, which is his attempt to do 2001 and Close Encounters underwater. And it's so clearly personal to him as a guy who in the 30 years since has put all of his fortune into advancing deep underwater technology and going on many of these exploration missions himself, making documentaries with National Geographic and Discovery and so on. And it's so bizarre, isn't it? But it is great. And as you say, the cast of characters, the technology, it's all there. But it is very long. Steph, which version did you watch? The longer or the shorter?
I watched the long version. Right. It's the only one available to me, so I did that. I don't think I'd seen this film before, which surprised me, because when I was young, my dad would show me basically every submarine movie ever. It absolutely terrified me. And I was quite surprised that I'm pretty sure I hadn't watched this before. I think the actual production story behind it is far more interesting than the film itself. I think the whole film is kind of like, watching an underwater level in Mario. It's so frustrating. The light is so dark, it's so claustrophobic, the speed that everyone moves is so slow, which probably accounts for the long runtime. But I think the general kind of, just the fact that they built these kind of like 50 foot high water tanks to actually be able to film in them, like the actual kind of pressure that the cast were under and the crew, and just the kind of lengths that they went to actually make this film. And also the fact that James Cameron, yeah, went into one of the deepest trenches under the ocean after that, and because he just like really wanted to explore deep sea.
So many of the stories are incredible. I think depending on who you listen to, every single member of the cast almost died at various points.
There's a brilliant making of, I think it's on YouTube, called Under Pressure, which is kind of feature length. It's just, I mean, extraordinary just to see the sheer scale of it. But you know, I think what puts Cameron is, and I get that it's kind of this sort of slower pacing, you know, especially compared to stuff today, but that's kind of what I really dig about, you know. I think he's one of those rare filmmakers that really takes the time to kind of set up a place and a space and, you know, the geography of, you know, where one room is, you know, in relation to the next, you know, the central hub where you've got the dive pool where the big, you know, fight takes place towards the end, and so on, and the big swim that they have to do as well to get to crazy Michael Biehn. I mean, all of this stuff is so brilliantly established at the start that when the payoff comes in the action sequences, such as they are, you know, you really know where one character is at any given time. You know where everything is in relation to everything else. And I think that really just kind of elevates the tension and the suspense in it. And of course, you've got the character drama that's bubbling away underneath that as well.
So a five-course full evening meal of a film, really, isn't it? Mm-hmm. There's so much in there, and it is one that you need to give your entire evening to. There's no looking at Twitter at the same time. There's no, you know, maybe I'll squeeze this in before we'll watch Strictly Come Dancing later or anything. You've got to give yourself over to it, and I think there's a lot in there that you get back. But watching it now, all I see is the kid, James Cameron, who was obsessed with the monsters of the deep, and he makes these futuristic sci-fi films in Terminator and Aliens, one going into the depths of space, and then once he's able to make this original movie, he goes to the depths of the planet and finds horrors there. I want to go back and rewatch The Meg, the Jason Statham movie from last year, because I think they rip a lot off from this, all the way down to the ex-wife coming on board or the estranged wife coming on board and it's adding a wrinkle to the drama.
It's interesting because I think watching this, I feel like there's a lot of more recent movies that feel quite similar. Like, it reminded me of Arrival quite a lot, in that kind of, do they want to hurt us, do they want to help us type thing. I think it's interesting, as a kind of influence on other sci-fi movies.
I mean, Terminator was, you know, is the second film this year that James Cameron has produced that another person has directed, and I think that Alita Battle Angel, which I really, really liked, I think pays a lot more, I don't want to say homage, I mean kind of respect to the Cameron way of doing things in terms of world building and stage setting and so on, than Terminator does. And maybe that's unfair to Terminator because it's like the sixth film in a series, so it doesn't feel that it needs to set so much up compared to Alita, which is creating this new universe.
And something that he'd been working on for a long time, so a lot of his DNA was in there.
But I appreciated the patience of that. It's almost kind of disappointing that The Abyss, for anyone else that hasn't seen it yet, is that it's only available on those crappy DVD. Because, you know, I know the Prince Charles shows it quite regularly on 70mm, and seeing this at the cinema, you know, versus the improperly framed DVD is a vastly different experience.
I love watching these movies in Film Club and just seeing, as you sort of alluded to, Steph, it is a start point for other things. But with The Abyss, James Cameron is a guy who builds his stable of collaborators and comes back to them time and again. This is a film with very few of those, apart from Michael Biehn, who had been in Terminator and Aliens before this. But Ed Harris, they never worked again. Mm-hmm. Ed Harris, for many years, said he would never talk about his experiences on The Abyss. Mm-hmm. He apparently punched James Cameron on set. But then Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio, who, growing up, I only knew from Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves.
Yeah.
And she's had this clutch of four or five roles in the 80s and 90s.
Scarface.
Yeah. And then what happened to her?
Can't tell you off the top of my head.
I think she's fantastic in this as the person who's introduced as the bitch from hell, or whatever the line is, but then all the way to her death and revival scene, which I think is an incredible dramatic scene that.
Maybe it says something about, you know, Ed Harris, really, because, you know, Sigourney Weaver's a trooper, keeps coming back, doesn't she? And although Kate Winslet, didn't she say she'd never work with him again after Titanic, and she's back for some Avataring?
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Okay. They all come
another
back
one to... underwater, isn't it? A big another his big next underwater spectacle.
Oh, everyone get their wetsuits out.
Oh, but where would you put this in the Jim Cameron canon, Matt? I'll come to you first.
Probably under the Terminators and Avatar and Titanic. I mean, about 5-ish above True Lies, below those.
Just set him off on this path of films that are north of 2 hours long and they just get more expensive every time.
I mean, yeah, I think all of those are kind of later films and he's got a lot more at his disposal. And all of his films afterwards, he seemed to take about a decade putting together. And, you know, this was pretty quick after Aliens. Mm-hmm. Oh, and Aliens, of course, above.
Yeah. Steph, do you agree?
I think this will probably be the lowest. I haven't actually seen Avatar.
Really?
I'm going to have to write that when the next five come out or whatever. But, yeah, just it didn't really work for me. I think I liked it when he had less money and I had to kind of work around that. And I just think it's, yeah, maybe if I'd seen the theatrical cut and it was a bit shorter and kind of trimmed down, I might have enjoyed it more. Yeah, interesting production, but I don't think it really pulls it off.
It is incredible looking at the budgets of his first four features and how it just increases exponentially. But I think Aliens was something like 15, 20 million. This was more like 60 million, 70 million. Then double that almost for Terminator a couple of years after and beyond, all the way up to Avatar at that time, the most expensive film ever made.
It really seems to let the technology drive the storytelling and, you know, not telling another story until, you know, the technology is there to do so. And he's the biggest gambler in, you know, I think I remember going to opening weekend of Titanic and, you know, the expectation on everyone at the time was that this was going to destroy 20th Century Fox. You know, that was it. And then, you know, the same again with Avatar, and now this, you know, $1 billion four film gamble that he's about to go on now, again, you know, shooting 3D motion capture underwater. I mean, it's just crazy. And I guess the best rule in Hollywood is that you just never bet against James Cameron.
But you'll be there for the Avatar sequels.
Absolutely. I mean, it's, you know, it's whatever. I think whatever you think of the previous ones, history so far has been on his side, at least.
Oh, I never had much of a relationship with the Abyss growing up. I was always the two Terminators and Aliens, and this is the missing link between those films. If you like that James Cameron vibe that he builds up in those films, the Abyss gives you more of that in spades. I don't think that it's one that I'll be returning to every week, whereas I think Aliens and Terminator 2 and the first Terminator are so rewatchable.
Yeah,
this one is a bit more meaty than those, but I'd love the opportunity to see this in a cinema, and hopefully one day I'll get that chance. James, if you can hear us, spend some of that Avatar money on getting The Abyss a new re-release, please. But that was The Abyss, rounding off our reviews this week. Before we sign off, any other business, Steph or Matt, anything to talk about, anything to plug?
Yeah, so I work with the Bechdel Test Fest and we put on female-led films around London, and we've got a screening on the 4th of November of Whip It, Drew Barrymore's directorial debut.
Brilliant.
And it's 10 years old this year, so we're doing a special kind of 10th anniversary screening. So if you want to come along to that, there's still a few tickets left.
Terrific. And Matt, you teased that because of Terminator Dark Fate, you're going to revisit an old article, right?
Well, we did, me and Adam Woodward, a few years ago now, we split the entire Arnie filmography and wrote them all up and ranked them and so on. So that needs a little bit of updating in the light of this new one. So hopefully that should be up in the next couple of days.
Do you remember what was up top?
No, not off the top of my head.
Is it Twins?
I can't actually remember. This is terrible. And I can't actually remember whether we ranked by performance or by film. I think it was by film.
Ooh.
And I think T2 is probably the one.
I think Escape Plan is one of his best performances. The bit where he has to rant and rave in German. It's terrific. I hope that's high up in the list.
I will check in a minute.
Okay, thank you both for joining me this week. Next week we have Doctor Sleep, the sort of sequel to The Shining by Mike Flanagan. We have Sorry We Missed You, the latest Ken Loach movie. And because we're doing belated horror movie sequels, Film Club next week is Psycho 2 from 1983.
Nice, great movie.
A really interesting film to talk about. Let us know if you have any comments on those films or the films we talked about this week at the usual channels. That's @truthandmovies on Twitter. truthandmovies at tcolondon.com via email or at the comments section at lwlies.com/podcast. Steph, Matt, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having
this
us.
Week.
Thank you.
I'm Michael Leader, and as always, this has been a 7Digital production.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.